I'm Mark Hennick. This is So-Called Normal. Hey folks, welcome to So-Called Normal. I'm Mark Hennick. Today on the show we have Martin and Farah Perlmutter, or Perlmutter. they're a husband and wife power team in the speaking world in Canada, but apparently they pronounce their own last name differently, depending on who you ask. Farah is the CEO and co-founder of Speaker Spotlight, and Martin is the president and co-founder of Speaker Spotlight, a speaker representation company that represents me, but that's not why I had them on the show. I had them on the show because they just passed their 30,000th booking of speeches across Canada and around the world. So we had a great conversation, I think, about the speaking industry, about getting into storytelling as a career, as a business. It's something that I'm fascinated in, given that it's basically my full-time gig now. And it was a real privilege for me to be able to unpack that further with them and how they balance that, you know, being a married couple, running a successful business, seeing each other all day and all night while they raise their family and look forward to next steps. So here's my conversation with Martin and Farah Perlmutter and or Mutter on So-Called Normal. So what are your titles? President and CEO?
Mm-hmm. Is that That's right. Yes.
Okay. So yeah. Martin's president.
Yes.
Farah CEO right. of one of the three big speaking agencies in Canada. Sure. I personally think my favorite, because you also represent me. So I should probably disclose that right off the top.
No bias there, but.
No bias at all. But I wanted to have you in on the show to talk about a number of things. I mean, you represent some of the most interesting, inspirational, powerful speakers in Canada and really around the world. I think you represent a number of international speakers as well. Mm-hmm. And you do it all while being married.
That's right.
Of course. Of course. And you just passed your I think I saw 30,000th booking.
That's right.
Yeah, it was quite a milestone. When we started, you know, it took us 6 months to get our first six bookings. So I actually did the math, because when we hit 30,000, I thought, okay, if we had kept that pace, it would have taken us something like 2,500 years to get the 30,000. So we obviously amped things up a bit. But
yeah,
it was fun. We hit that marker and we thought it's something to celebrate, because when we started, we really had very modest goals for the business and wasn't a number that was even conceivable back then.
So the first six bookings, when was that? How long ago was that?
About 24 years ago.
24 years ago.
And we're still married. And happily.
After all that.
Yes.
Yeah. So what did that look? Well, first of all, right at the beginning, where did you get the idea to represent speakers, to connect speakers with events? Mm-hmm.
So I was working in an advertising agency. So I was about 24 years old. And my uncle asked me if I can work on his promotional materials, because he wanted to become a speaker. Mm-hmm. And I said, absolutely, I would love to, but what's a speaker?
Right.
So
was the speaking industry, quote unquote, you can't see my air quotes on the mic, but was that a thing at the time? Was it?
Well, if it was, I didn't know about it.
Right.
And I had never seen a speaker.
Right.
So I thought I better do some research. So while working full time, I started to go to NSA meetings, which are National Speaker Association meetings. And in mm-hmm. Canada, they were called CAPS. Canadian Association of Professional Speakers. Mm-hmm. So I started to go to these meetings, and that's when I really saw this whole world.
Sure. So there was an industry in place.
There was.
At the time.
It was, I think, a lot smaller than it is now. Mm-hmm. It was also, this is pre-Google, mm-hmm. right? The commercial internet was just becoming a thing. So there really weren't there wasn't a lot of information readily available where nowadays, you know, you just go on Google and you search whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't easy to actually find information and figure out what this industry was and who the players were. And
right.
So it took a little bit of sleuthing to figure out exactly, you know, what it was and do the research.
Yeah.
And I was practicing law at the time, and I was realizing that wasn't the career that I wanted for myself. So
how long did it take you to realize that?
About 15 minutes, but I stuck it out for another 6 months or so.
Okay.
So it wasn't my thing. And so, yeah, we were young and naive and thought, you know, we're 25 at the time. We thought, hey, let's start a business together. How difficult could it be? And that's the advantage of having youth and naivety, which is a nice word for stupidity on your side.
And it's a good thing we didn't know.
Do you think you wouldn't have done it if you knew?
Well, I think maybe we would have been a a little bit more hesitant. I mean, I have no regrets. It was the best idea ever to quit our jobs and start our own business. But also having no idea what we were doing, we took these amazing risks. And we tried so many different ideas that no one else tried before. So we really stuck out and we got noticed quickly. And we just kept trying new things. We didn't even know that no one else was doing them because we didn't know what anyone else was doing.
Right. So. Well, what was that first talk that you booked? Do you remember?
I actually looked back at it because when we got to this milestone, I looked and the first one, first engagement I think we booked was a gentleman named Alan Simmons. And I think, was it like Country Style Donuts or something like that?
Country Style Donuts.
Yeah, it was like a franchise meeting. And that was actually the very first one.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I don't remember a whole lot about it. I think it went well.
But we're still here.
Yeah. But we had some interesting ones, you know, early days and learned a lot. You know, that's, as Farrah said, you know, not knowing what we were doing, not coming from this industry was a huge advantage in a way, because there were lots of things that we tried. Some worked really well. Some failed miserably, but we learned from, you know, what wasn't working. We did more of what was working. And so we had, I think, a bit of a unconventional approach to the business. I think if we had worked in the industry for a few years and then decided to go out on our own, we would have essentially taken a model that we already knew. And so we just did things a little differently and just what made sense to us. And you know, we did a fair bit of research before we launched in, but when we did start the business, we both quit our jobs at the same time. So we essentially went from two incomes to zero overnight.
Wow.
So it was pretty scary. It was a big sort of leap of entrepreneurial leap of faith is the way I'd describe it.
That first 6 months trying to get those bookings, you know, did you have a point where you thought, oh, what did we do?
It was not easy.
It wasn't easy. Also, we were working out of our apartments and one little room in our apartment, and we were sharing the phone. And we had no clients and we had no money or experience.
I was making probably about 80 to 100 cold calls a day.
Which just randomly looking through the phone book.
And we joined a couple of organizations. So there's an organization called MPI, Meeting Professionals International, and we joined that and we got their membership list. So it literally just started going through that. But we would go through the phone book. I remember calling IBM Canada and getting the main number and asking who plans their conferences and just, you know, having silence on the other end of the phone and getting bounced around from person to person to person until finally, you know, we started to get somewhere. And then you start to realize, okay, these are the people's sort of job titles or descriptions within an organization. So it was a lot of that. I mean, the way I would best describe it is those early days. And I think this is for a lot of people who start a business from scratch. It's kind of like banging your head against the wall 100 times a day. But after a while, it doesn't really hurt that much.
And eventually it starts to feel good.
Yeah, in a weird way. So that was kind of like, but you know, we were young, as we said, and you know, we weren't that far removed from being students. So going back and living like students wasn't difficult for us. We didn't, you know, and
we didn't have kids then. Didn't have a mortgage. We didn't have a lot of stress in those ways or demands on us. We didn't have a lot of money, but we had a lot of time and we were extremely driven and we were really happy.
Yeah,
it was fun. And it's funny because when we reflect back, when we started the business, we actually said, let's do this until it's no longer fun. And when it's not fun, we'll try to do something else. And, you know, luckily, I think after all these years, we're still having fun. It's very different now than it was in those days. And when we look back, some of the, you know, best memories are actually the early days when we were struggling and just, you know, trying to figure out what to do next. And for me, there was never a moment where I thought this was a mistake. Like it was hard. And there were months where we got shut out and literally had zero booking, zero revenue for the entire month. But we had a really long-term view of the business from day one. So we weren't really worried about what our monthly or quarterly results were. We had a much longer term goal in mind, and we knew that we were laying a foundation. And even though, you know, we would not measure our success based on how many bookings, it was, you know, how many relationships were we forming, how many people were we connecting with. And it was really that, I think, kept us going, because sometimes you'd have these great connections and it may not turn into anything at that time, but we felt like at some point this will hopefully pan out. So
I remember after TEDx Toronto in 2013, where I did my talk and I signed with a representative, and somebody paid me to speak for the first time. And I thought, wow, this can happen, because I was doing it for free. I was just doing it anyway. And I was like, oh, I can actually follow my passion and do something that I really love doing. Mm-hmm. So do you remember the moment or around the time where you really felt like, oh, there's something here. We can actually make this work, when things started to turn for you?
Yeah, there wasn't necessarily one moment, but there was a few. Mm-hmm. There was one piece of business I'd been working on for months, and it didn't look like it was going to go anywhere. And after 3 or 4 months, the client decided to move ahead, and they booked, I think, 6 speakers for their conference, which doubled our output overnight. We went from 6 bookings in the first 6 months to all of a sudden now we have 12.
Yeah.
So that wasn't like a moment like, oh, we've made it, but it was like, okay, there's progress. It just, and I learned patience, and that was, I'm not the most patient person by nature, but this business, if there's one thing it's taught me, is patience, because it takes time to build trust and it's not easy. You know, if it was easy, everyone would do it. So
that surprises me, though, that you don't characterize yourself as patient, because I've only ever seen you as pretty even.
So I'm calm. Like, I think I have a calm demeanor, but
just melting down on the inside.
Yeah, but I think it's just we wanted things to happen. Like, we were eager and enthusiastic, and we felt like, you know, if people just give us a chance, we'll prove ourselves.
Right. We had long-term goals, but our goals were very modest, looking back. Mm-hmm. I remember I had a small little filing cabinet next to my desk. It had 2 drawers, and I had my files in there of my clients, and my goal was to fill both drawers of clients. And I'm like, that's when I'll know I've made it.
Right.
And now if you go into our office, we have a whole room full of filing cabinets packed.
Yeah.
And we have to periodically go through and purge them, you know, because we can't give. And so back then, we would never in a million years imagine where we'd get to.
Yeah.
So it was very steady, organic growth. We never borrowed from the bank money. We never borrowed from our parents. We never went into debt. Mm. So we really wanted to do it very steadily, organically.
As you reach those goals, are you great? I'm sure you're grateful, but is it a thing where you feel good about that, or are you always setting new goals to try to reach? You know, I guess I'm wondering if you're content with the success that you've reached.
Definitely not content.
Yeah.
I think you've got to continue to strive forward, and the business changes, the industry changes and evolves, and I think you just have to continue to try to obviously stay relevant, be ahead of the change if you can, and anticipate where things are going. So I think for me, as soon as we, you know, sort of rest on our laurels and feel like, oh, we've made it, that's probably the beginning of the end.
I think so. Also, I think that's what makes it really fun.
Yeah. Right. And the challenge of it.
Also, by working with all of our incredible speakers,
they
really make us creative and they inspire us. And you can't help but continue to grow as you work with these fascinating people. So it just happens.
Well, speaking of fascinating people, I mean, you represent some pretty big names. I mean, Clara Hughes in the mental health world, of course, is a big name, but also Chris Hadfield, Simon Sinek, Neil Pasricha, he's been on the show. You represent some really great names. Who have really impacted you? What are some of the talks and people that you've worked with over the years that really left a mark on you?
Well, one person who pops into my mind is Margaret Trudeau. And she really took a chance on us when we were first starting out in our little apartment.
Oh, really? She's been with you for that long?
Over 20 years now.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I remember she came over. You know, looking back, it's unbelievable that she took a risk on like these two young 20-something-year-olds.
Yeah.
And she came over, and so she was sitting in our little living room with us.
She came to your apartment?
Yeah, to our apartment.
The home office, headquarters.
The world headquarters. And we really didn't know much.
Right.
But I think she picked up on our enthusiasm and our drive, and this is, you know, before she came out with her own challenges, and now she talks, we book her to talk about bipolar and all everything that she's gone through. And when we book her to speak, I watch the audience, and I see the impact that she has on so many people, and that's what really moves me. So I know that she's making such a difference because I see it, and I see, and she has a huge lineup of people waiting to talk to her afterwards, and they hug her and they tell her about their own experiences, and it's so moving. I just love her.
And that you've been able to make that connection, to facilitate that, to put her in front of those people at that time.
Well, I guess we have a part of it. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
That's the best feeling, I find. Yeah. You know, for us, being in front of the camera, in front of people, is not where we're comfortable, or at least I'm not where I am. I'm very comfortable being behind the scenes, being the one helping find the right speaker, you know, make those arrangements, and then being at the back of the room and just watching, you know, the magic happen. Because if you get it right and you get the right speaker in front of the right audience, right time, that's when, you know, you can feel it in the room. You can feel the impact it's having in the moment. And then, you know, the potential for long-term change, that people may hear something that they might apply to their life or their work that could have a profound impact.
How important do you think it is? I mean, Margaret Trudeau now in particular, because she has, she's doing so much more now. She's having a real renaissance, not that she ever really went away, but especially 20 years ago too, when it was closer to her then husband being prime minister. How important is it to have a big name like that when they're telling such vulnerable stories? Are people coming for the name? Are they coming for the celebrity? Or is it really the story that, that affects them?
It's often both. It depends on the type of event, but it has a huge impact. I mean, another speaker in the mental health field that I feel has had a profound impact on me as well as the audience he's spoken to is Clint Malarchuk. And the reason I think, you know, I mean, there's a number of incredible people we work with, but Clint is a former NHL goaltender. Tough guy. You know, if you go on YouTube and watch clips, you'll see clips of him fighting other goalies, other players. Like most goalies weren't great fighters. He was a tough, tough guy. And he grew up, you know, in rural Alberta and just, you know, as a cowboy. And he was someone who never wanted to admit that he needed help in anything growing up. And he had a lot of challenges. I mean, he had severe anxiety, OCD, depression. I mean, he dealt with a number of things and then had a horrific accident on the ice that's widely considered the worst accident in any sports ever. I would not recommend going on YouTube and looking at that. It's pretty horrible. Yeah. But he now, his purpose, he defined his purpose in his life, going out and sharing this message of all the things that he's overcome and dealt with throughout his life. And I think for him, it's really powerful because as a man, as a kind of a tough guy who's never one who would ask for help, he admits that he couldn't get through it on his own. And the only way to get through it is to seek help and is to surround yourself with good people and get the type of help that you need. And I've been in audiences, I've seen construction audiences where it's typically like burly middle-aged guys who are tough guys who are all of a sudden you see them wiping their eyes kind of pretending like there's something stuck in their eye maybe or what have you. But he shared emails with me from attendees. He blocks out the names, but he shares the feedback of people who say that, you know, they've struggled with things for decades in some cases and refuse to get help. And now after seeing him are now seeking the help that they need. So that for us, similar to your purpose, I think that's why we do this. I mean, we have this opportunity to change lives, and I'm not so Pollyannish and naive to think that every speaker is going to go in front of an audience and everybody's life is going to change. But I think if in the right circumstances, it can have a profound and long-term effect. And it's affected our lives too, going back to your question. You know, there's no question that the people, the speakers that we've worked with over the years have changed the course of our lives.
It's interesting because we work with a variety of speakers, from many different types of business speakers, a real breadth of topics. But it seems that the most requested topic is mental health right now.
That's interesting. And when did you see that starting to pop as a trending topic?
It was probably about 10 or 12 years ago, I'd say. And when, and as you said, I mean, when people like Margaret and Clara Hughes and others were willing to come forward and speak about that and share their experiences and open up, I think it gave permission to a lot of people to speak more, you know, publicly about it. So I think that that's been a huge change in having, you know, having people who, you know, are associated with success and, and, you know, whether it's in sports or politics or business or whatever it is, be willing to open up. I think it's just an incredible thing because it just allows the conversation to take place everywhere.
You have Shane Feldman. You have Drew Dudley, who's with you now. Both have been on the show as well. What makes they're great speakers. I've had the great privilege to see them live as well. What, in your opinion, makes a great speaker, a great storyteller on stage?
I'll jump in.
Okay.
We finish each other's sentences sometimes.
I imagine.
So, I mean, there's a few things. I think it's something that, that to extend is a gift. Some people are just born with a gift to communicate, but it can also be learned. And I've seen speakers improve a lot. Connecting with an audience is obviously why you're there. And I think that, you know, the best speakers, it's not just the ones who are the most articulate or the most passionate. I think it's the speakers who can connect their message, their story, their expertise with the audience and put the audience into their story. And I think that that to me is the difference between a good speaker and a great speaker, is they don't just tell a good story or have interesting information to share, but they really relate it to the audience and let the audience see themselves in the story. And then I think when they do that, that's when I think there can be a profound impact and connection.
Yeah.
Also, I think a talk that is well rehearsed is important, but not too polished.
Right. So you see the clear beginning, middle, and an end, that there's a point to it, but that it's not scripted. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I could see a speaker do the same talk five times, and I know exactly what's about to happen, and I know it so well, but it seems so authentic every single time. You know, it's relaxed, and it's as though he or she is saying it for the very first time.
You know, that's been an interesting evolution, I think, in my own speaking. And I've had the opportunity to talk to a couple of people just about, you know, to geek out on speaking, where I think I went through a period where I felt like an imposter almost, of needing to dig back down into really authentic, raw emotions. I mean, I talk about suicide. I talk about the darkest times in my life. And when I talk about it, I really access it. But I've done it so many times also that when I leave the stage, I can just tuck it back away again and go on with and go have tacos for lunch and be with my family. And like, it's not that big of a deal for me anymore. That doesn't mean that it's inauthentic, though, when I pull it out. And I think I went through a period of time where I felt like, no, I hope I don't lose that connection.
That's exactly what I mean.
Yeah. How do you think people do that? How do they? I've been thinking of it as a almost method acting, that you have to enter into it and slide back out again. But have you seen speakers approach that differently? How do you think they do that?
Well, I actually asked Amanda Linhope.
Right. So another very powerful speaker.
Oh my gosh, she's phenomenal. So she was abducted in Somalia. She was a journalist, and she was held captive for, do you remember how many days?
Almost a year and a half.
Yeah, almost a year and a half. So she obviously suffered quite a bit in many different ways, but she talks about forgiveness and resilience. And when she speaks on stage, it is so raw, and she often gets emotional. And it is the most powerful presentation, and the audience is very affected afterwards. But it's a great presentation. Always standing ovations. And afterwards, I asked her once, I said, like, and she often does like two in a row or like multiple days. And I said to her, how can you like physically go through that all the time? And she says often it's catharsis, and and she wants to do it, and she needs to do it, and she knows she's other people need to hear her story and her message.
So you do feel it. Yeah, I think you do feel it build up when you haven't been on a stage in a while. At least I have. Yeah. Martin probably knows when he starts getting a lot of emails from me every day. Oh yeah, we should probably put him on a stage sometime soon.
Well, I think just in general terms too, I think as a speaker, I think the key is to just continually evolve the talk and refresh it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the core message may be the same. The story, if it's a story-driven talk, isn't going to change. The facts aren't going to change. But as you change as a person, as you evolve and go through your life, it may mean different things to you, and they may, you know, maybe different messages that you're extracting from it that may be helpful to people. And I think that's really key. Like if you take Olympic athletes, for example, you know, there's usually after every Olympics, there's a few Olympians who become popular speakers because they won a gold medal or whatever it is. And the ones that can just only tell the story of like, this is how I won, this is how I trained, this is how, this was what happened the day of the race. And you can only tell that story so many times. And then you become bored of it, I think, and the audience can pick up on that. But the speakers like the Mark Tewksbury's of the world, who 27 years after he won his gold medal in Barcelona, are still one of the most popular speakers out there. It's because he's more than just that one race. And he told that story for many years. And then the message has evolved. He's evolved as a person, his experiences. And so it's just continually making it fresh, you know, and if it's not fresh for the speaker, you know, if the speaker's bored of the talk, the audience is going to be bored of the
talk. You can notice right away. What do you think are some of the other, you know, mistakes essentially or pitfalls that speakers sometimes fall into?
Well, I can tell you one mistake I think some speakers out there make, not our speakers.
Of course.
Other speakers.
You wouldn't let that happen.
Well, a pet peeve of mine is selling anything from the stage. So selling a book, selling any type of materials. So I would say that's a no-no.
Right. It feels dirty.
Yeah, not good.
You know, I think Farah mentioned over-rehearsing. I mean, it is important to be prepared, but it's, I always say, you know, better to get 70% of the words right and have 100% of your passion and enthusiasm for the topic come through than get 100% of the words right, but only 70% of your passion. So I think some speakers are really they want to make sure they get every single word right. And then you can almost see they're in their own head and it's more of a performance, like they're an actor. And I think that it's more important that the, you know, the enthusiasm comes through and you know, you're going to flub some words and that's okay. In fact, it actually makes you appear more human and people can connect with that. And just, you know, being true to your topic. Well, we get a lot of speakers reaching out who are interested in doing this. And, you know, so what's your topic? Like, well, what do you want me to speak on?
Right.
And it's like, that's not the approach. You know, I think you've got to speak to what, you know, is your expertise is or what you're passionate about and not worry about whether that is a trending topic at any given time.
Mm-hmm. And if you know your stuff, you don't have to really rehearse as much, I find, because you know your stuff, right?
Yeah.
You got to be able to be coherent with it. But
And stories trump data. I mean, it's important to have data. It's important to have facts. You know, that's, you can't, you know, it drives me crazy when speakers go up and they don't really have any authority or expertise on a topic and they're just throwing things out there. And it's like, you know, where is this information coming from?
Right.
So it's really important to be, you know, as a speaker to either be grounded in your own personal experiences. That's one type of talk or research or expertise that you have or a combination, which I think is one of the things I like about your talks is it's personal experience and it's also backed with, you know, your experience working in the mental health field.
Right. I try to qualify that repeatedly, though, with a bit of usually self-deprecating humor that I'm nobody's expert. I only know my own stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that, well, by the way, humor, you know, and self-deprecating humor is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. But I think that, it's just important to remember that stories are what connect often with the audience. And if the talk is too data-driven or too factual, not enough narrative and stories, I think you can lose an audience. So I just think that it's really, I think great speakers are great storytellers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it too is knowing in your core that you're doing your best, that you know your stuff, and not everybody's going to receive it the same way. I mean, Martin knows about this. I don't know if you know about this, Farah, but I did two events probably two or 3 years ago with it, or whatever it was. Maybe it was sooner than that, but two events, this exact same talk to two very similar audiences. One was a rave review, the standing ovation. It was a great, they did a big spread in their magazine and all this stuff. And the other one didn't like it at all.
But it was the same talk. I think there was one person who complained.
Oh, well, maybe, well, regardless of that, but the reason that I raise it isn't because I still have an axe to grind. but it's that you can't always control how other people are going to receive your story.
And that's the interesting thing, I think, as a speaker is, you know, when it goes great and it's a 10 out of 10 and it's like, you know, amazing versus when it maybe feels like it wasn't your best performance. And the question is it the speaker? Is it the audience? Or is it some combination? It's usually a combination of the two. And, you know, you never know. And I think as a speaker, one of the challenges too is audiences are more and more distracted. Mm. And so, you know, people are on their phone sometimes and doesn't mean that they're not interested. It might mean that they just got an important text from their kid or from their boss or whoever it is. So I think as a speaker, you just got to, you know, really, again, focus on delivering the best talk you can and knowing that, you know, people, you can't always read an audience perfectly.
Right. It could be that they're taking notes on their phone.
That's right. Yeah. I think you can tell the difference from the stage when people are checked out or if they're really, really with you. Yeah.
In the old days, people just pull out a newspaper.
Were there, very subtly.
Oh, I was just gonna also provide a few more things that speakers should avoid.
Yeah.
So one thing is around visuals. Mm. So when you have a visual on the screen, don't put too many words. Mm-hmm. Also, don't use your visuals as a clutch. Mm-hmm. We see that a lot too.
And then people looking at the screen a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then if you know, the AV doesn't work, which does happen, then they're like immobilized on stage.
Yeah.
So make sure that you're ready to go without your visuals as well.
Yeah.
Also, know how to use the stage properly. So don't stand behind a podium. Mm-hmm. Don't use notes. So all these little things speakers really have to learn how to.
It really is an art
there
to
is.
It. And,
right.
and it's amazing to see because when someone has the gift to do it, and often, you know, it's funny. Sometimes people go to a conference and it looks so easy and they go, oh, I could do that. I could be a speaker. And usually, you know, when you see a speaker who makes it look effortless, it means they've put a lot of work into it. It's not the first time they've been up on that stage.
And that's where I think I landed, where I evolved from the feelings of imposter syndrome and potential risk of inauthenticity. I realized, oh, no, actually, I'm just getting really comfortable at doing this and that's okay.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I think you're right, being able to get up there and I know exactly when I'm going to make say that word incorrectly or when I'm going to make that little seemingly offhand joke that I happen to have made 100 times
That's right. And so it looks authentic.
It looks authentic and you also test it out and sometimes things work on stage. And I think that I like like when speakers do that, when they take some risks and they try mm-hmm. something out. Maybe yep. it didn't work. Okay, well, you file that away and That's you don't right. do it again.
That's right.
But some stuff, when you take those risks, really lands well, mm-hmm. I think.
Another thing is customization mm-hmm. for the audience. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to rewrite a new speech every time.
Right.
Definitely. But just to provide a little bit of content that's specific for that particular audience would really go a yeah. long way.
Yeah. Even just, finding anecdotes or examples mm-hmm. from their industry.
Exactly.
I find can be helpful. How have you seen it as, and I've tried it both ways, you know, more interactive talks versus more the person just doing their tight mm-hmm. one person show. Mm-hmm. Which do you think works better? Or does it depend on the audience?
I think it depends on the speaker, actually. Right. There's a few speakers I can think of. I think he had Mark Bowden on the show.
We did, yeah.
And he often interacts with the audience. I mean, he's very interactive, even in mm-hmm. his keynotes, even in a large room, 1,000 people, and he can still do it. And he just has that ability to go in and interact and then bring everybody back mm-hmm. and to him when he goes back on the stage and continues. And so that is not easy to do. Mm-hmm. Like, he has incredible command of the stage and of the audience. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of speakers, if they try to make it interactive, they can lose the audience. Like, everyone mm-hmm. starts doing their interactive exercise, and then, you know, good luck trying to get 800 people to mm-hmm. focus back on you. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not an easy thing to do, especially in a large audience. You know, it can be effective, but I think it's a unique skill. It's more of a facilitative type mm-hmm. skill. And so for the most part, you know, I think especially, again, if it's a larger room, larger audience, it's probably better, more effective for the speaker just to do sort of the monologue type thing from right. the stage right. and then maybe have some, you know, Q&A or something afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's, or I've noticed, but I don't know if it's just me, is there a stigma against the quote unquote motivational speaker, you know, the Tony Robbins type speaker? It seems like that's a dirty word too, right?
I've never been that comfortable with the term motivational speaker. And someone says, you know, what do you do? I'm a motivational speaker. I don't really know what that means.
Yeah. Right. Inspirational is better.
Yeah, you like inspirational speaker
better. There's like a story behind them.
Yeah. And so I think, and it does, there's this image that for some people come up of the sort of Tony Robbins type person who's up there, and it's a lot of energy, a lot of hot air in some cases, maybe. I don't know.
But some people like that.
Yeah, some people love it. But I think to me, like a speaker of substance who has something to say, like that's the most motivating thing to me, is learning something new and having someone be able to share something that something clicks in your head and you think, oh, I think I know where I can apply this to, you know, whether it's personal life, professional life.
Yeah.
To me, like those are the most motivating speakers are the ones who share new ideas that kind of spark something in your brain.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it depends on, you know, what the audience, even down to the individual member, wants. Do they want to be motivated? Are they paying to be motivated, or are they paying to do something else?
Yeah. And the question is, what does that even mean? Like, that's the sort of generic criticism of quote unquote motivational speakers, is it's kind of like the Chinese food metaphor where, you know, you fill up on that and then you're hungry an hour later.
Right. Oh, I've never heard that before, but that is interesting.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, to me, the whole point of the talk, it's not, if it's just energizing for an hour or so, that's just entertainment to me, really.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if it's really going to be truly motivating or inspiring and have a long-term effect, then it should plant some seeds. And you know, again, it's up to the individuals. A speaker's not going to change anyone's life in an hour.
Right.
They can just plant some seeds, and then it's up to the individual to take what they've heard and learn and hopefully find ways to apply it to their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about speakers, but on the client side of things, what's some of the feedback that you've gotten from clients or audience members? You mentioned that briefly, that you really, really connected with you and you knew that you were doing good work.
Oh, you know, it's interesting. The hurricane and the letters you would get.
Yeah. Well, it kind of goes back to a question of speakers who inspired me. So Reuben Hurricane Carter is one that's really inspired me. And, you know, he was a African-American boxer who was arrested and convicted of a triple homicide in 1966 in New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey, and spent 22 years in prison and was eventually freed and exonerated. And I mean, the impact he's had on me was huge. He passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. But the feedback we would get from audiences, and that's what makes it all worthwhile to me, is, you know, just seeing the impact that a speaker can have on an audience. And it's different depending on the speaker. Sometimes it's individual people in an audience who are just moved by the speaker. But we see our clients as the speakers, as well as the organizations or companies hiring the speaker. And that's obviously, at the end of the day, there needs to be some type of ROI, some return on the investment of bringing the speaker in. And it's amazing when, you know, you get feedback later of, you know, a speaker came in, it may be a business related topic. And then you know, when you're following up with them later, you're hearing that actually this person made an impact and we're taking, you know, this approach, whether it's to sales or marketing or leadership, and it's actually having an impact on the organization and whatever the goals that they were, you know, if it's a leadership meeting, maybe it's engagement levels within the company are lower and mm-hmm. someone can come in and deliver some content that's going to help the leaders be more effective in engaging their teams. And then you hear later that it's actually been a huge improvement in that. And so those are the kinds of things that mm-hmm. that from a business point of view are really rewarding because, again, it's not, you know, we don't see ourselves as slot fillers.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. you don't see our yeah. job as someone has an hour to fill at a conference and we fill that hour. We really look at the impact that it can have on the individual people in the audience, as well as the organization bringing the speaker in. And so, again, every organization has different goals and objectives and challenges and opportunities. And, mm-hmm. and any way that we can help them with that, you know, is a win for everyone, I think.
Yeah, I always ask in the conversations that we have before an event with clients what their intended outcome is. If, mm-hmm. you know, they want to, I do two essentially very different types of talks. One is an information-based one and the other is more of an inspirational one. And so that's what I asked them. I said, do you want your people to feel something or think something?
Right.
Because those yeah. are two kind of different approaches as yeah. a speaker, I think.
And that's the most important question. Yes. I always say that I think Stephen Covey, you know, begin with the end in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a client's struggling in terms of they know they need a speaker, they're not really sure, you know, maybe their boss has just said, go out and find me a quote unquote motivational speaker
right.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The question I think is the most important one is that when people leave that room, leave that meeting, leave that conference, what do you want them to have heard and learned and felt?
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, what do you want them to do differently as a result?
Mm-hmm.
And when you can get that objective clear, then it becomes a lot more obvious to us in terms of, oh, this would be the speaker or the, you know, two or three speakers to recommend, because, you know, the topic might be leadership. And sometimes mm-hmm. we get requests where, you know, the client says, oh, we have a conference and the theme is leadership. And there's thousands of people who speak right. on that topic and in very different ways. So
yeah.
it's really understanding again what the objective is, you know, and I love that whole idea of, you know, sort of begin with the end in mind. What do you want people to do differently when they leave?
Yeah.
And then work back from that and help them, you know, sort of recommend the speakers that we think will best achieve those goals.
Yeah. How do you, now you're also, in addition to working with all these speakers, you don't do this by yourselves, of course. You have a fairly large
oh, yes.
staff
yeah,
of people in your
fantastic
office.
Fantastic staff.
Right. And that's been my experience as well. They're all amazing, mm-hmm. everybody that I've encountered so far. So how many people do you have who work for
you? 35 now.
35. Yeah.
And
yeah.
when we started, by the way, we thought best case scenario, like if things go better than we could possibly imagine, we thought maybe one day we'll have three or four people working with us and we'll get it out of the apartment, you know, move into a real office. So never really a goal to grow a bigger team.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened organically, as Sarah mm-hmm. said. But it's been one of the best things for me about this whole journey is just seeing people develop and grow and have opportunities to play to their strengths and mm-hmm. that's been a really, really amazing part of this.
Mm. So how do you share your enthusiasm for this industry and all of your experience over the years with your staff? How do you get them, you know, to be able to communicate with clients in the way that you did from your apartment mm. all those years ago?
Well, they may say we have too many meetings.
I mean, I think part of it is just genuine enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, we shouldn't be representing any speakers that we don't really believe in mm-hmm. and are genuinely enthused about.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that to me, like I always say, like I had no sales experience of any kind before this business. I was, my only previous jobs were lawyer, as I mentioned, where I had no responsibility to bring in business. I was just a grinder basically. And then prior to that, Little League baseball umpire and camp counselor. So
do any of those skills come into play
not
now?
Not really.
For you? No.
Yeah. But the thing is, so I think that for me, like if I had to go out and sell, I don't know, life insurance, I'd probably be terrible at that because I don't necessarily understand for me, you know, I understand the benefit of it, but it's not something I'm really passionate about.
Right.
But for this, you know, what we do, I'm really passionate about it. So I think the key is finding people who really love the business because, you know, we've interviewed a lot and hired a lot of people over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the hardest things with any business is finding and keeping great people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things I've learned is it's the people who love the business, who, you know, believe in what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
and the impact our speakers can have, how we can help our clients. You can teach the skills in many cases,
mm-hmm.
but if they have, you know, it starts with that enthusiasm and that belief in why we do what we do and the impact it can have. And then, you know, we've never done any formal sales training, for example, with salespeople, because I've never had any formal sales training.
Right.
So I think it's just everybody, you know, there's ways, you know, everyone has a little bit different way of doing it, and it has to be an authentic way of communicating, you know, and that's on the sales side. And then same with all parts of the business. It's just, you know, we're dealing with human beings. At the end of the day, our product, if you will, are human beings, you know, people telling their stories and sharing their expertise. But all of our clients, whether they work for a huge multinational company or a small nonprofit, you're dealing with a human being. At the end of the day, it's one-on-one connections and treating people well and treating regardless of whether they have a huge budget and a huge event, or it's a community group and they're, you know, putting together a community event and they really don't have a huge budget, but they want a speaker to come in and speak. To us, it really doesn't matter. It's you don't treat one group better than the other. You treat everyone the way you would want to be treated. And that's, I think, been the key.
Yeah.
Once a week or so, we have a speaker come in to tell us what's going on, their new topic, a book they're working on, sort of a behind the scenes look at what speaker's working on. We invite our entire staff to come into that meeting, and we actually videotape it, and it's on our website. It's called Inside Our Boardroom. So everyone,
and there's a Mark Hennick episode Inside Our Boardroom.
Yeah.
Everyone can see a part of it. And so by having these meetings, I think everyone becomes inspired and motivated to work.
Yeah. Well, they get to learn from the speaker, but also to get to know them. You know, it's easier to sell somebody that you know.
For sure.
Absolutely. Otherwise, a piece of paper, you know, a bio on a website only does so much. But when you meet the person, you really get the feel, you know, for who they are and kind of why they do this. It helps a lot. Yeah.
And just generally, they're more excited to do their job and to have pride in what we do and knowing that they're making a huge impact out there.
Yeah. So now, how do you divide the workload between both of you? Do you have defined roles? I mean, you're the CEO and you're the president, but what does that even mean?
Farrah's the boss, basically.
She's okay.
There we go. Yeah. At home and at work.
I was just going to say, but what about at the office?
No, it's a really good question. And so this is the only, we're not experts in couples working together, although I guess we've had a lot of experience. And I think we learned early on, we had to separate our roles. So at the beginning, we were kind of both doing essentially the same things, and we have very different skill sets and strengths. So we realized that we needed to separate our roles, each focus on the things that were our strengths, the things that we enjoyed most, and have sort of a clear division of roles. So from kind of fairly early on, Farrah's role was really around the marketing and that side of the business, and mine was more the sort of the sales and operations, I guess. And to this day, you know, there's a lot of things we collaborate on, but there's, you know, I think the key is to kind of know your roles, know your lane, stay in your lane. You know, and the same thing with our whole team really is, you know, you want to put people, I think, you know, I love the Jim Collins metaphor of the bus, right? And you want to get the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus. And then you want to figure out what seats to put them in, you know, where their strengths are, and then make sure the bus is going in the right direction. And so I think that really is the key, is just clear understanding of what each person's roles are. And sometimes you need to collaborate and sometimes it's a solo effort, but that's been really key, I think.
I've seen lots of people who have either just been friends or as couples who have gotten into business together, and it rarely doesn't work. But it seems like it works really well for you guys. I don't know if I could do it, to be honest. To
not
say,
for everyone.
Oh, I'm going to
really
see you later too, aren't I?
Yeah.
So how do you keep home out of the office and vice versa when
it's
you're always
really
together?
Difficult.
Sure.
And we try not to talk about it at home, especially around our kids.
Right.
So we really focus on our kids when we're home. And we used to have a rule that we would not talk about work after 8. That was our rule, and not on the weekends. But it's really impossible.
Yeah. Well, when our kids were young too, we told them, like, we're not going to talk about work. So they would call us out on it. If we're having dinner and all of a sudden the conversation, we start talking about something that happened, they go, hey, you guys aren't supposed to be doing that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, which was good. So, you know, certainly before we had kids, that was when the business was in the early days. It felt like 24/7. And that was okay in some ways. I mean, we loved it. And it was exciting. And it was this new adventure we were on. Once we had kids, the focus shifted at home to, you know, we need to be parents and And so we actually don't talk about work that much at home. Mm-hmm. But it's not easy for couples. And it works well for us, but it's not perfect all the time, for mm-hmm. sure.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, the thing I think to keep in mind is that you've got your roles at work, but you're still married. You can't be like, okay, I'm going to yell at you at work, but then everything's going to be good at home. It's like, and that's the thing with everyone, I think. Like, I think it's really difficult for anyone to go and act a certain way at work and then come home, you know, and then be like different. I think, you know, you play mm-hmm. different roles in your life, but I think you have to be a consistent person. Mm-hmm. So like if our kids, for example, now have worked a little bit part-time in our office, mm-hmm. and if they saw me, for example, at work the way I am speaking to a client or speaking to members of our team, they wouldn't be like, who is that guy? That's not mm-hmm. my dad. It's like, I think I'm the same person. I think they would say that. Yeah. I may speak to them, my kids, a little bit different than I'd speak to a client. Or
sure,
you know,
sure.
But at the end of the day, it's, you know, I think there's, you know, consistency there. And I think that... And the advantage I think that we had working together too was we started when we were really young and early on in our relationship and right at the beginning of our marriage. I think it might have been tougher if we had both worked for 10 or 15 years in separate jobs.
Right.
And then we decided after that time, hey, let's start something together. Mm-hmm. Now we're bringing all this sort of baggage and other things mm-hmm. from other experiences, which could benefit us because you have all these experiences, or it could be difficult.
Right.
And I think for us, we kind of grew up together doing this. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it was like our relationship, our business, everything sort of at the same time.
Yeah.
Or it would have been hard if he had more experience in this industry than me, or right. vice versa. But right. we both didn't know anything.
Just started from the ground level right. and yeah, figured it out as you went, yeah. it sounds like. Yeah. 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 So you have two teenage kids, I think?
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. How's that?
I
met your son. I don't know.
That's right. You did. Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know if I've ever met your daughter, but
yes.
Yeah.
So she's 19. Mm-hmm. She's in second year university. And then our son will be 17 in a few months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're teenage years are actually a lot better than we thought. We were like
really?
Kind of terrified.
They are.
It's fun. I mean, the relationship as parents with your kids changes and, mm-hmm. and
we're very close.
Yeah.
Our whole family is close.
Yeah. And we're lucky. Our kids still seem to be okay to hang out with us. Sometimes we went to a yeah. movie on the weekend with our son and he wasn't like horrified to be seen with us on a,
right.
you know, in a public place.
Yeah.
So, so we're pretty lucky, but,
we hang out with them a lot.
Yeah.
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 So, and they obviously, they worked in the office, so they know what you do and they have an appreciation mm-hmm. for it. Have there been any speakers that you think that they've benefited from as well, kind of coming into contact with your work?
Yeah.
Well, our son specifically said he loved hearing your talk.
My talk?
Yes.
Okay. Well, tell him I said thank you. That's very nice.
One of our speakers, Peter Katz, who's a musician, would be a great guest for the podcast.
Yeah.
Really interesting guy. Mm-hmm. He actually spoke at our son's school.
Yeah.
And and our son is a musician as well, plays guitar. So Peter's talks are really around just sort of staying with it. And mm-hmm. you know, he describes himself, I think, as a 1 or 2-time Juno Award losing artist. he's not a household name. He's not someone that everybody necessarily knows, but an incredibly talented musician. Yeah. And he's doing really well. And, you know, his message, I think, really resonated a lot with our son, just because the being an artist, being creative,
sure.
sticking, you know, following your dream and sticking with it is a great message for anyone to hear.
Yeah.
And so they've benefited from getting to know and see some of the speakers, but we didn't really want to just like integrate them into
sure.
this. So it's like it's a weird thing, because when I was growing up, like I would never see someone on television who I knew. Whereas now they'll like look on TV and they'll be like, oh, there's so-and-so.
Right,
and it might
yeah.
be someone they've seen. But yeah. I think things are so different now anyways that with kids, you know, just it's just nothing really fazes them. And but I think hopefully they've learned a little bit from, mm-hmm. from they're more likely to listen to you, for example, or one of our speakers than us.
Yeah.
So maybe we should use this as a parenting strategy.
Yeah.
If there's a message we need them to hear, we'll just
sign on a speaker.
Yeah.
Hey, come to this talk.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You're the only one in the audience.
Right.
Actually, our daughter and Amanda Lynn have become very close.
Really?
They text each other.
Yeah.
And
nice.
It's really amazing.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So you've got the head office in Toronto. You mm-hmm. just opened an office in Calgary as well.
Relaunched it.
Relaunched the office in Calgary. Okay.
Bigger
is there plans for future growth, or this is where you're settling?
Not specifically in terms of geographic. Mm-hmm. We're just continuing to do what we do. I mean, it was never a plan to open an office, for example, in Calgary.
Right.
And just the opportunity came up. I mean, this was actually about 12 or 13 years ago that we started with the office in Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a new office there now. So that was what we were launching recently.
Okay.
But, you know, if the opportunity came up, I mentioned Jim Collins. I'm a big believer in the first who, then what strategy. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. rather than saying, you know, a lot of businesses, this is a strategy, and then they'll go out and find the people to execute the strategy. And we've always found the people first, and then the strategy, you know, sort of goes with that. So that's how the office in Calgary came about, was Marnie, shout out to Marnie, we had known and started working with her and opened the office in Calgary for us. And it was based on her, because of her, because she's just a great, great person. And so that's grown there. So you never know. We'll see.
No
plans for world total domination yet. but
maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
We're going to be empty. Right. We're going to be empty nesters
next year. Yeah, so, that, yeah. And that's where I was kind of bring this around to, is like, if you're in what, 2 years, I guess?
This time next year,
you'll have the house all to yourself, theoretically.
Right.
So any plans for retirement, or are you just ramping up? What are you going to do then?
We'll work more.
Work more, yeah.
I think...
Martin is less equivocal about this.
Yeah. We are.
We're a little more equivocal, rather.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what that's like. It's going to be a change, for sure. But we've always tried to strike as much of a balance as we can, and tried to, you know, every decision we made with our business, actually, we brought family into that decision. And, mm-hmm. and one of the questions we'd ask ourselves, is this going to make our lives more simple or more complicated? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is more complicated, we often would not do it. And, you know, our kids have always been a big factor in terms of, like, you know, we thought at one point, you know, a lot of people saying you should open an office, for example, in the US. Well, if we did that, it would be a lot more travel back and forth. And is that something we wanted to do, especially when our kids were growing up? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've been pretty happy to, you know, sort of keep things simple, and we'll continue to. But we'll see. Maybe we'll have a lot more time and energy.
Open an office in Hawaii or Santa Monica or somewhere nice.
Yeah, somewhere, exactly. Beach office.
Exactly.
Yeah. But that'll be an interesting, you know, it'll be a new phase of life for sure. And it'll be bittersweet, I think.
Yeah. Hard to imagine.
Yeah. Well, you won't have to soon, and I look forward to seeing what you do with it. You know, I'm so grateful that both of you came in, but also that I've had the privilege of working with both of you for the last, I guess it's been 2 years or something that we've been working together. So, you know, I went through that transition myself just a couple of years ago, saying, you know what, I'm going to quit this big fancy job and go off and do the speaking and writing thing full time, because that's what I'm most passionate about. And I wanted to do more of what I loved to do and less of what I didn't love to do. Mm-hmm. And you guys made that possible for me. So I'm really grateful that you came on the show, but also that you've done that for me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we feel so honored to work with you. We really do. Yeah. And thank you for all the work you're doing.
Thank you. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you both. Okay, that's it. That's my conversation with Martin and Farah. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a bit about what makes a great speaker and maybe some of the things that you can avoid in the speaking world. And, you know, I think that anybody who wants to share their story, and people ask me all the time how they can open up and share their story about mental health and mental illness, even about suicide, do things like... do the things that I do. And I think it really does start with knowing what you want to talk about. Farah mentioned that as well. Knowing what your own story is and then giving it some shape. I often tell people to write their story out a few times, not as a script, but just so you can get it straight in your own head. And then you can play with how you actually tell it. So it was great to have a conversation with them about all things speaking world, and I recommend you look them up at speakers.ca. If you want to book me or somebody else, I mean, we mentioned a bunch of other incredible speakers, especially in the mental health space. Margaret Trudeau, Neil Pastricia, Shane Feldman, Drew Dudley, lots of people who have been on this show as well, and lots more people who will be on this show in the future, I'm sure. So go check them out at speakers.ca and on all their social platforms as well. While you're on social, you can look me up at Mark Hennick. That's at MarkHennick on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, everywhere else to learn more about the show. You can see when I post every single Monday on the new episodes, the new guests that we have. Or you can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, which I'd really like you to do, because that supports the show. So head over to Apple Podcasts, look up So-Called Normal, click the subscribe button, scroll down to the bottom, leave us a star rating, leave us some thoughts in the comments. comment section. That would be great too, and share some of these episodes, all of the episodes if you want to, with your own networks too. I think that's it. You can learn more about me over at markhennick.com, markhennick.com, where you can get more updates on the show as well. Okay, that's it. I'm out of here for now. We'll talk to you next Monday on So-Called Normal.